ISKCON founder acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai, nama acharya Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai. Paramsu kaho Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Sri Gaura Bhaktavinda ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktavinda ki jai. Gaura Prayanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the lotus feet. Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Namo Bhagavate
Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 18, the battle between Lord Four and the demon, Hiranyaksha. This morning is text number 2. This time we have it on the board so we can chant it. Dadarsha,
Dadarsha,
Tatra,
Tatra,
Abhichitam,
Abhichitam,
Dhara,
Dhara,
Dharam, Praniyamana,
Praniyamana,
Avanim,
Avanim,
Ogra,
Ogra,
Tamshtraya,
Tamshtraya,
Mushnantam,
Mushnantam,
Akshna,
Akshna,
Swaruchaha,
Swaruchaha,
Aruna,
Aruna,
Sriya,
Sriya,
Jahasa,
Jahasa,
Cha,
Cha,
Aho,
Aho,
Vana,
Vana,
Gocharaha,
Gocharaha,
Vigaha,
Vigaha,
Dadarsha Tatra Vichitam Dharadaram,
Dadarsha Tatra Vichitam Dharadaram,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Sriya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Sriya,
Jahasa Chaho Vanagocharo Mrigaha,
Jahasa Chaho Vanagocharo Mrigaha,
Dadarsha Tatra Vijitam Dharadharam,
Dadarsha Tatra Vijitam Dharadharam,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Staya,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Staya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swaruchor Runa Shriya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swaruchor Runa Shriya,
Jahasa Chaho Vanna Gochara Mrigaha,
Jahasa Chaho Vanna Gochara Mrigaha,
Dadarsha Tatra Vichitam Dhara Dharam,
Dasha Tatra Vichitam Dhara Dharam,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Shriya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Shriya,
Jahasa Chaho Vanna Gocharo Mrigaha,
Jahasa Chaho Vanna Gocharo Mrigaha,
Dadarsha Tatra Vichitam Dharadaram,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Praniyamana Vanim Agradam Straya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Shriya,
Mushnantam Akshna Swarucharuna Shriya,
Jahasa Chaho Vanagocharo Mrigaha,
Jahasa Chaho Vanagocharo Mrigaha,
Dadarsha Tatra Vichitam Dharadaram, Adarshadatrabhijitam Garadaram
Aniyamana Vanimagratam Straya
Dramiyamanam Agradam Straya
Ushnantam Akshna Svarucho Unashtiya
Ushnantam Akshna Svarucho Unashtiya
Jahasa Chaho Vana Gocharo Mriga
Jahasa Chaho Vana Gocharo Mriga
Yadāśa-tatrā-vijitāṁ-garādharam
Pramīyā-manāvānim-āgradāṁ-straya
Uṣṇāntam-lakṣṇā-svāru-chodhu-nāśriyā
Jahāsa-chaho-vāna-gocharo-mṛgā
He saw.
Tatra.
There.
Abhijitam.
Abhijitam.
The victorious.
Dara.
The earth.
Daram.
Bearing. Praniyamana.
Being raised upward.
Avanim.
The earth.
Agradamstraya.
By the tip of his tusk.
Mushnantam.
Who was diminishing.
Akshna.
With his eyes.
Swaruchaha.
Hiranyaksha's own splendor.
Aruna.
Reddish.
Shriya.
Radiant.
Jahasa.
He laughed.
Cha.
And.
Aho.
O.
Vanagochara.
Amphibious.
Goes both on land and water. Amphibious.
Mriga.
Beast.
Translation, he saw there, he meaning the demon, Hiranyaksha, he saw there the all-powerful personality of Godhead in his boar incarnation, burying the earth upwards on the ends of his tusks and robbing him of the splendor with his reddish eyes. The demon laughed, "Oh, an amphibious beast."
Srila Prabhupada's purport.
In a previous chapter, we have discussed the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Varaha, the boar. While Varaha, with his tusks, engaged in uplifting the submerged earth from the depths of his waters, depth of the waters, this great demon, Hiranyaksha, met him and challenged him, calling him a beast, Mriga. Vanagochara Mriga. Demons cannot understand the incarnations of the Lord. They think that his incarnations as a fish, or boar, or tortoise are big beasts only. They misunderstand the body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead even in his human form.
And they deride his descent. In the Chaitanya Sampradaya, there is sometimes a demonic misconception about the descent of Nityananda Prabhu. Nityananda Prabhu's body is spiritual, but demoniac persons consider the body of the Supreme Personality to be material, just like ours. Abhijananti mam mudha, persons who have no intelligence deride the transcendental form of the Lord as material. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namani Namaste Sarasati Deve Gauravani Kacharani Nirvishesha Sunyavari Paschachare Satarane Omam Gyanam Kimaram Dasya Gunanjana Shalakaya Chatsuru Militum Jain Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpa Trukhyascha Dripa Sindhu Vyeva Chapatitanam Bhavane Vyo Vaishnavayo Namo Namaha. So now he sees the demon going looking for a fight, finds the Lord, and he sees him here. The Lord is called Pavijita, means ever victorious. Dharadhara, he's Dhara is the earth. Agra dumstra means a tusk. You know, the boar has these two long teeth that come out. They're called tusks, like elephants have tusks. So agra dumstra on the end of his tusk, or is avani. Avani is the earth. Being another name for the earth, being raised up, and because he's been down there, this has all been recounted in an earlier chapter, I think the 13th chapter of this canto, where the appearance of Lord Varaha is described, and he's going down to rescue the earth, and then it is mentioned, by the way, that while he was setting the earth on the water, and he killed the demon, and so then Madhura says, you know, well, who's this demon? What about him? And then the whole story of Kashyapa and Aditi and all this stuff is been told here. So now we have. So here, the Lord's eyes are reddish, and it robs Hiranyaksha of his own radiance. But here in Yaksha laughs, he says, Aho Vanagotra Nada. A beast, which is Vanagotra. This word Vanagotra, it can mean a forest animal, but it can also mean an aquatic animal. So here it's taken to mean both. It says normally a forest animal, but now coming out of the water, so amphibious beast, he says jokingly. Making sport of the Lord who has the earth on his tusks. At one time, some of us were trying to figure out the issue. What do people think of the earth as? The BBT picture that we used to have, there's this ball, you know. Sitting on his tusks. But then we find out from the fifth canto that the earth is actually not like a ball, but something else. And anyway, what is it? If it's fifth canto, is it the whole of Bhumandala that's come down? Or, I mean, the whole Bhumandala? Or, you know, what fell, really, when you say the earth? So we started looking for old depictions of this, just to get an idea, from India, like carvings on the walls of temples or deities, from India, They tended not to show this ball, at least before the 19th century, but they showed kind of a mountain on his tusks. It's like a mountain, like a couple of peaks on his tusk. But in the really older ones from really old temples, it's Bhumi, it's Bhudevi, it's the earth, this is and that's through in these really old carvings, she actually has no clothes on. And actually, the first thing I had to be reminded of this movie King Kong, you know, he's got this big hairy with this beautiful little girl. That must be the origin of that story, in a way, because King Kong is really, I think originally some kind of divine being. I mean, these modern stories that people make up are really just perverted reflection of the real stories. And so this is the origin of this story, where rescues a beautiful woman. There are actually they're considered Bhudevi is the wife of Varaha. In the fifth canto, it describes the nine varshas of Jambudvipa, and then each varsha there is a form of the Lord who's worshipped by a great devotee, and it goes through the starting from the east and goes around and up and then back down again, ending with varsha. So in the varsha called Kuru, the one at the far north. East means east means to the right. If you're standing north, you're always in Vedic culture. Everything is you're facing east. Really, that's the first direction, and. So Bhardvarsha is the farthest one south. So the farthest one on the other end, you know, in east and west, there's only one Varsha. Ilavritta Varsha is in the middle, and there's one on each side, east and west. And then three to the south, three to the north. That's the. But the extreme north, Uttarakuru, Varaha is being worshipped by Bhudevi. She leads everybody in the worship of Lord Varaha, and there's some nice prayers there to him by her. As there is mentioned that she's his consort. And of course, they have had a child together. Now the story I heard, I can't remember where I read it, but when she was on his tusk, she became impregnated by his tusk, which is like, it's a spiritual body. One part can do the function of all the other parts. And so, you remember who their child is?
Narakasura.
Yeah, Narakasura, also known as Bhaumasura. Mm. Yeah, that's their child. And killed by his father, really, Krishna.
By Krishna.
Yeah.
But he had a blessing. He could not be killed without the consent of his mother. So therefore, Krishna took Satyabhama into the battle.
That's right. She was on the... came.
Mm-hmm. And the expansion of Satyabhama, so therefore Satyabhama, she is actually also the mother of this Narakasura.
That's right. She is. That's explained.
And when Narakasura threatened to kill Krishna, then Satyabhama said, "Now you may kill him."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what happened. Narakasa, remember, he had imprisoned all these princes who never, now they couldn't get married, so Krishna married them all. Married about 16,108 he married them all. So this is a family affair here. Interesting sort of story there. So. Well, this is absolutely coming with the earth is there. Bhudevi on his tusk, having been rescued by the Lord in his animal form. So typically, Prabhupada regards the demon is that he cannot appreciate the Lord. He said, so when he calls him an amphibious beast, it's a criticism. But Varaha is interesting. His body is spiritual. Krishna has so many forms, and he's not just anthropomorphic in a human form, but he's zoomorphic in an animal form. Some places Prabhupada says he incarnates in every species of life, which would mean that there's a lot we don't know about. But the Lord's forms are innumerable, so. And Bhagavatam is just a sample. Prabhupada mentions that in the upper planets they go through many more pages of Bhagavatam than we have here. So there's. So he appears in this way, Prabhupada says, not just as a human, but fish, matsya, varaha, purama, these three are all worshipped in Jambudweep. Also Hayagriva, in a horse-headed form, is there at the same time. Nisringadeva, half lion, half man. This is sometimes scandalous to Christians and other people who think it's beneath the dignity of God to show up in anything less than a human form. Of course, as they understand a human form, it's also beneath his dignity. But we have to say, our answer is, why not? You have to see that if you see all these different forms in the world, that they are in some way derived from the Supreme Lord. So the Supreme Lord has form. The argument against his having form by so many people is that if God had a form, he would be limited. Because as soon as you have a form, you're this and you're not that. By the way, as far as Prabhupada is concerned, to say that God is a person means to say that God has form. It's almost by definition. This is the same, actually in English, anyway, in older English, the word person what was simply synonymous with body. And so you see the word person used in older literature, somebody's being attacked and the Savior imposes his own person between, you know, his body. This is an old sense of the word. Anyway, but see, Prabhupada defines person. He says somewhere that to say the absolute is a person is to say that the absolute truth has senses. So these senses, when we say senses, when indriya is a Sanskrit word, right? And so indriya means the gyanindriya, hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling, those instruments for doing those things, which are manifest in the human body, these eyes, two pairs of eyes, ears, you know, there are all kinds of eyes out there in different forms of life, but we have these sorts of eyes. You know, flies have these compound eyes. And a sense of taste that's mostly on the tongue. But fish, for example, because they live in water, their taste buds are on the sides of their bodies. Prabhupada said fish life is all tongue. Their bodies are sort of a tongue in itself. Because they're in water, and so they taste. So they can pick up these tastes. So that we have the instruments for seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and smelling. And then that's called the gyanindriya. Then the karmindriya, you can say, are those instruments for doing. That's karmindriya. If the gyanindriya, they're the kind of the instruments by which the world comes into us. And then the karmindriya, more or less, by which we act on the world. So there's the karo, the two hands, is usually described like that. But really, they're the instruments of manipulation. Because again, you know, some people have claws, and some, you know, they're all different. So but some instruments of manipulation and the legs, the instruments of locomotion, of moving from one place to another. Again, the instruments of sound production. That's where the tongue is serves a double function. On the one side, it's for tasting. So it's a gyanindriya, and then the tongue, together with the vocal cords and other things, is a part of the karmindriya for sound production. So instruments for sound production, and then the instruments for reproduction, genitals, and for passive waste. So that's the ten. Sometimes the mind is also the common sense. It's also sometimes considered an indriya. Anyway, so if you look at what a body is, it's just a very organized arrangement of these different instruments. In some animal forms, one is more prominent than another. Dogs have big noses for smelling. Their sense of smell is very acute. Although science has just discovered that if a human being gets down on the ground and puts his nose to the ground, they also smell much better. Their sense of smell becomes more acute. They're amazing how much a human being could smell if they were down there. Isn't science wonderful? So animals have so much hair in their body, so that means their sense of touch is very, very strong also, like a cat, you know, because the hair is part of the instruments of the sense of touch, the skin and the hair and so on. So anyway, you can see that when we say a form or a body is just this organized arrangement of these indriyas. So to be a person means you have senses, and to have senses, if you understand both karmindriya and gyanindriya, means you have a body. These organized about a mind, and of course, ultimately a center of consciousness. So to say the Lord is a person, from Prabhupada's point of view, is the same thing as to say he has a form. somehow or other, in Christianity, they kind of have the idea that God is a person. But as one William James remarked, a mythical person. Because they think if he had a material body, it would be like ours. And that's infradig, as they say, infradignitatum, beneath his dignity. So therefore, but somehow or other, they have this idea that the mind is more spiritual. Of course, we know what the mind is like. It's even worse than the body. As far as being below God's dignity. Anyway, so they think of him as a mythical person. And that's their experience. People hear him like as over a telephone or something like that, by some remote speech, either delivered or by an intermediary, or they hear his voice. The one time where God is encountered, in the Bible, God is depicted as walking and all these things, as a person. But it says that when Moses went to the top of the mountains to receive the Ten Commandments, what it really says in the Bible, it's actually in the most translations too, is that that he could not see God's face, he could only see his back, or his backside, meaning his rear end. So it says he has a face, and he has a rear end too, but Moses couldn't see his face. That's what it says. Now most everybody, the commentators, you know, they all know that's kind of a symbolic and this and that and the other thing, but and they try to get rid of that body because of some kind of idea. This is the idea that if God had a form, it would be a material form. So on the one hand, there's this idea, this projection, that if God had a form, it would be material. Now, who says, or why is this said? Who says that all forms are material forms, or that all names are material names? But this is why Prabhupada calls the Gyanis who have this philosophy of negation. He calls them empiricists, empirical speculators. And the reason is because they use their own sense experience as the basis for their understanding. In other words, they're the ones that think that form by definition is material form. Because that's all we see. That's our whole experience. If I say to you God has a spiritual form or spiritual qualities, you'll have to say, what is that? All I can imagine from a material point of view is form or its absence. And what the Lord's form is something that's simultaneous, as sometimes it's described, simultaneously with and without form. Or you find Krishna described in the Bhagavatam in different places as, really, if you look at the Sanskrit, it says, the qualities of one who has no qualities. Or sometimes the form of one who has no form. Now, every time Prabhupada translates that, he says, the form of one who has no material form, or the one, which is what it means. But for those who are Gyanis, it's more starkly paradoxical. It's like a contradiction to them. They can't understand how you can be simultaneously with and without form. But he can do it. So he has this spiritual form. Now there's the other idea that if God had a form, he would be limited. There's a Lutheran theologian, a liberal Lutheran theologian, German, Paul Tillich, who came to America and was big professor and very famous for some time, teaching at the University of Chicago. He was a real Mayavadi. So because he argued very famously, and he became on Time magazine and all these other things, because here he was, a Lutheran theologian, and he was denying that God is a person. He said, his argument is basically, God cannot be the supreme being among all beings because that would limit him. He would be one among many. So therefore, his speculative conclusion is that God is being itself. Later, he thought that was still too materialistic an idea. And so he said, well, not actually even that, but the ground of being. Right? So that's his argument. If God were one being among many, he would be limited. So that's the idea of a person. Again, if I say Krishna, that means there must be something that name points to, and that there's a person means, here I am, there's my boundary, usually at the level of my skin, and that's the self, and then there's the environment. So immediately to be a person is to be limited. This is how these people speculate. So God is unlimited, that means no boundaries, therefore not a person. It just seems like an elementary factor to their speculation. Well, of course, we have to say, well, if God can't be a person, isn't that a limitation too? He can't do it, he can't be a person. So that's really what it comes down to. See, they want to preserve the transcendence of God. So clearly, name is limiting, no name. And of course, form, no form. Qualities, again, God is a this and a not that. Limited. Or the other way to think of it is in terms of being relative. Relative means related to something. If you think about the words you use, relative, it means one thing is related to something else. So that the absolute then means, there are nothing, no relatives. And so that ekam eva advitiya brahman. Brahman is one, and there is no second thing. That's why eventually the Mayavadis, their understanding of this is Brahman satya jagan mitya. There is no world. Mayavadi philosophy really says, and Prabhupada points this out and shows us very clearly, Mahaprabhu says it actually when talking to Prakasananda Saraswati, that the Mayavada philosophy means that the absolute truth has no energies. They deny the energies because it's not relative. Even if you tell this to a lot of people who think they're Mayavadis, they're shocked. Because they have this Mayavada philosophy, they pick it up from somebody like Swami Vivekananda, who's just totally inconsistent. He claims to be following Shankaracharya, but he really doesn't. Because Shankaracharya is so thoroughly anti-world that the world doesn't exist. I mean, you take something and you give it the lowest possible value, you say, yeah, the world is there, but it's useless, worthless. Go further, it's not there. Kill it. Right? Put it out of existence. That's Shankaracharya. It is really, really
He just takes his ideas and carries them to their final conclusion, and the world doesn't exist. Well, since Vivekananda wanted to spread this Mayavad philosophy in a place where people are thinking the world's a great thing, he's tacked on to it, you know, based on the Christian missionaries and everything, you know, charity work and all these other kinds of stuff. And it makes a real hodgepodge. But anyway, this is the idea of the absolute, that besides which there is no second thing. As soon as there's two things, relative. Now, look at Krishna. He's got tons of relatives. He's got mothers, fathers, friends, devotees. He's not only is Krishna a relative, he's supremely relative. He's related to a world, he's related to his devotees. Now sometimes, like you can be related in such a way that at least it's a one-street relationship. You affect them, but they don't affect you. You affect them, but they don't affect you. This is the standard Christian idea of God. It's really a one-way street. And Krishna is that way in relation to a good deal of the people in the material world. But when it comes to his own devotees, he becomes controlled by them or by their love. He's the one that gets tied up by his mother. He's the one that spends hours and hours and hours trying to convince Radharani to talk to him. You know, I mean, he's really controlled. He doesn't come under the control of his external potency. That's what it means to say it's external. But where his internal potency is concerned, he becomes supremely relative. So, that's why this philosophy that Mahaprabhu says of achintya-bhinda adhyayana-tattva is so important. Because it gets us out of this impasse of, see, what Tillich says, God cannot be the supreme being among all beings, because that would limit him, therefore he's the ground of being. What we have to say is this is a false dilemma. God is simultaneously the supreme being among all beings and the ground of being. Both. Therefore, not limited. If he can't be the supreme being among all beings, he's definitely limited. He's, as people always say, he's just energy. Here you're talking about the greatest of all, and you have to use this word, just. He's only energy. You know, like electricity, which I can do whatever I want to with. We have to see God as you can see what they do when they're going to try to recognize the transcendence of God by this philosophy of negation. Not this, not this, not this, not that. Trying to understand the greatest of all, unlimited, and then they come to the idea of nirvishesha Brahman, and so here is Brahman, which is the great, but has no name, no form, no qualities, no activities. How is it different from nothing at all? It's just a big zero. But it's a cosmic zero or something, or a holy zero. But why do you end up with just the opposite of what you're saying you're going to get? You're going to get the greatest and you get the least. So something is wrong with this process. That's why all these conceptions of God are really, really quite lame and crippled. They don't think it all the way through.
So when we speak of Krishna, therefore, we say he's one without a second. There is no second thing. It's true. And at the same time, he is the greatest among all others. He's one without a second because nothing is different from Krishna. There's nothing but Krishna. One without a second. Yet nothing is Krishna except his own primordial personality. The Prabhupada puts it this way, and at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. So this is Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. That's just not some theory. That's how we should see. That's the way to see. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. And the other place Prabhupada says, there's nothing but Sri Krishna, yet nothing is Sri Krishna, save and except his own primordial personality. These are very nice ways to put this. I just memorize them and think about them all the time and try to see that way. So this is now you're getting somewhere into some actual conception of the Supreme Personality of God. And in one sense, it's inconceivable. Nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. How is that possible? But that's the philosophy that pervades the whole of Bhagavatam. So he's a person. Now again, you say, well, here's Krishna, but again, he's limited because he's blue cowherd boy, wears a peacock feather in his head. Not just that form. Therefore, he has innumerable forms. This is what Brahma Samhita says. Advaitam. Begins with that word, Advaitam, without any duality, Achutam, Anandam, Anantarupam. Anantarupam. He has endless forms. Because just one would limit him. How many was there? So there's actually no limit. And all these forms are one and the same Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prabhupada says we have to understand this fact with conviction. You know this story, he says this in the purport to, 4.9? Janma karma chitabe divyan ilyo vedi tatapaha. It's very far out purport. Is that 4.9 or 4-something else? I can never remember the numbers that go with the verses. Yeah, it's 9. For once at 9. Janma karma chame divyam evam yo veti tat putaha chakva deham punar janmam naiti mam eti sorajinara. So Krishna says, this is a shocking verse because it actually, Krishna starts off by talking about his janma and karma. That's normally the signs of a conditioned soul. They take birth, they perform activities in the world, fruit of activity, janma and karma. So anyone, janma karma, he begins with this, janma karma chane, but then he says divyam, right? Transcendental, and certainly not ordinary. Evam yo veti, anyone who knows them, tattvataha, as they really are. Chakva deham, that person, when he gives up his body, purna janma naiti, there's no more birth for him. Iti mam eti, and he goes to me. In other words, if you understand my janma and karma as they really are, then for you there's no janma and karma. So Krishna's janma karma are really potent because somehow or other one can just understand it. Then you're liberated.
And this is what Prabhupada says in the purport. He says, one who can understand the truth of the appearance of the personality of Godhead is already liberated from material bondage, and therefore he returns to the kingdom of God immediately after quitting this present material body. Anyone who just understands it. Then he says his liberation is very hard for the Mayavadis and people like that. They spend a lot of time, and even then what they get is going to the Brahma Jyoti, which is partial and precarious, so they can come back down again. But then he says, but the devotee, simply by understanding the transcendental nature of the body and activities of the Lord, attains the abode of the Lord after ending this body and does not run the risk of returning to this material world. And then he quotes this from the Brahma Samhita, Advaita Machuta Manadim Anantarupam. So now he's, Prabhupada is doing, is starting to tell what it means to understand Krishna's janma and karma. So the first thing is, although there are many transcendental forms of the Lord, they are still one and the same Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's one God only, the absolute truth, the ultimate source of all energies, but with many transcendental forms. Then Prabhupada says, one has to understand this fact with conviction, although it is incomprehensible to mundane scholars and empiric philosophers. They're empiric, he means Mayavadis, empiric philosophers. I explain why he calls them empiric, because really, they really, all their argument is based on their sense experience. Then he quotes from the Vedas, the one Supreme Personality of Godhead is eternally engaged in many, many transcendental forms in relationships with his unalloyed devotees. That's the Purusha Bodhini Upanishad. And then he says this Vedic version, meaning a Shruti mantra, is confirmed in this verse of the Gita personally by the Lord. And then Prabhupada says, he who accepts this truth on the strength of the authority of the Vedas and of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and who does not waste time in philosophical speculations, attain the highest perfectional stage of liberation. Then he makes it even more intense. Simply by accepting this truth on faith, one can without a doubt attain liberation. You have to understand it with conviction. And then he has this really funny thing, where he, in a way he's making fun of the Mayavadis. The Vedic version, Tattvamasi, is actually applied in this case. Tattvamasi is from the Chandogya Upanishad, where the teacher is telling his students, Sweta Ketu, that he's explaining Brahman. And he says, you know, he thinks, this is greater than the greatest and pervades everything. And then he says, and Tattvamasi, and that you are. And then again, there's another passage, Brahman, and then Tattvamasi, that you are. So for the Mayavadi, this is one of the Advaita Vakyas, they call it, the statements of non-difference. So for them, this is the liberating, it's the Mahavakya, that you realize the meaning of Tattvamasi, that is to say, I am Brahman, then you're liberated, right? But Prabhupada has just said that doesn't really work very well. So, but now he's talking about accepting Krishna. Understanding Krishna, you're liberated. But he says, so the Vedic version, Tattvamasi, is actually applied in this case. Anyone who understands Lord Krishna to be the Supreme, or who says unto the Lord, you are the same Supreme Brahman, Tattvamasi, the personality of Godhead is certainly liberated instantly. And consequently, his entrance into the transcendental association of the Lord is guaranteed. So instead of, it's not that aham Brahman, you know, tattvamasi, I apply it to myself that I am Brahman, but rather you, the tvam is Krishna, are that, param Brahman. You are the Supreme Brahman. That's
then we're liberated. With, if we say this with conviction. So we just have to understand this. The word Brahman is the absolute truth. Right? So we're talking about the ultimate source of all energies. And we also understand that the energies and the energetic are none different. So there he's one thing. One problem is for most theists is they don't understand the concept of the absolute truth. In the preface to Srimad Bhagavatam, right in the foreword of the preface, I don't know what it's called, he points out right away that the concept of God and the concept of the absolute truth are not on the same level. And that the Bhagavatam is targeted on the absolute truth, the concept of the absolute truth. In other words, by God, Prabhupada is thinking of the word Ishwara. So, as far as the concept of God goes, in principle, there can be many gods. Now, like, for example, if you think of Krishna simply as Ishwara, then, because the term applies to him, and we even say Parameshwara, the Supreme Ishwara, but still Ishwara means that I can also be Ishwara. At least it's logically possible. Or are there many Ishwaras? Krishna's Parameshwara. Why? Why is he Parameshwara? Why that one? Why not this one? Maybe they rotate to take turns or something. But if you understand that Krishna is Param Brahman, he's the Brahman, the absolute truth, the ultimate source of all energies, then in principle there's only one. He's that one from which everything else comes. He's the self-sustaining sustainer of all others. If you look, there's this dependency. I'm dependent. We know from the Vedas that ultimately I'm dependent on the demigods. They supply all my necessities. So where do the demigods get them from? They may pass them out. They have to go somewhere else. Well, does this chain ever end? Yes. It ends in a unique being. Unique means only one of a kind. A unique being. This is the one unique being that he supplies everything and needs no resupply. I run out. I take money from my wallet and hand it to my children and everything. And then it goes empty. I need resupply. I'm passing out slices of pizza and the pizza's gone. I need resupply. The demigods also, they need resupply. When you finally come to Krishna, he's where it stops. He gives and gives and gives and never is diminished. His wallet is always, he takes out and it stays full. The pizzas that he hands out, the pie stays whole, right? Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat. You take away Purnat, he's still Purnat. There's only one like that. That's the absolute truth. And then you understand the relationship between the absolute truth and the energies. Then you're getting somewhere. Now, Ishwara also applies to Krishna. In other words, in linguistics or philosophy, they always make a distinction between. They're different terms. One is sense and reference. In other words, sense means the meaning of a word, and reference means that those class of things it applies to. Sometimes this is called in English also connotation, meaning, and denotation, what it points to. So the word Ishwara Param Brahman, Parameshwara, Param Brahman, they have the same reference, Krishna, but the meanings are different. because the meaning of the absolute truth, you have to understand this is what we say when we say Krishna. In other words, when we say Krishna is God, really what we mean is Krishna is the absolute truth. He didn't, how did he get to be the absolute truth? Why is he that? Well, he just is. That he is the personality of God. That's how Prabhupada uses that phrase, the personality of Godhead. What a great phrase. Huh? Supreme personality of Godhead. Godhead, that's, it goes in the English language from German back in the Middle Ages, Gottheit. So it denotes the absolute truth. And so, but that absolute truth, there's personality there. But then there's maybe many personalities of Godhead, but Krishna is supreme personality of Godhead. That's a great phrase. And so this is what we have to understand. If we understand all this, then Varaha is no problem. Yeah, definitely. Why not? Are these forms amazing, astounding, unusual? Yeah. Because you're dealing with, look who you're dealing with. He's got to be a boar. He's got to be a tortoise. He's got. There's no limit. Why should God be limited, you know, by somebody's little shopkeeper's understanding? Why does he have to be some stuffy bourgeoisie uptight factory owner, but transcendent? You know, I mean, everybody hates that God. When I say to people meet, they say, I don't believe in God. I say, why don't you tell me, describe the God you don't believe in? And I can always say, I don't believe in that God either. Let me tell you about Krishna. So this Varaha is quite amazing. Earlier, when he appeared in the 13th chapter, the sages praise him. The sages say, oh, unconquerable. They use the same word, jitam jitam. Unconquerable, enjoyer of all sacrifices. Oh, jitam jitam ajitam. All victories to Ajita, Yajnabhava, who is understood by the performance of sacrifice, the enjoyer of all sacrifices. You are moving in your form of the personified Vedas. They say, Trayim Tanu, your body is the Vedas. So where do the Vedas come from? The eternal. What are they? Well, they're the body of the Lord. And especially that body of the Lord which embodies the Vedas is Varaha. And the hair holes of your body, in the hair holes of your body, all the oceans are submerged. For the reason of lifting up the earth, you assume the form of a boar. And somehow or other, Varaha is particularly embodied and associated with sacrifices. Your form is worshipable by the performance of sacrifice, but souls who are simply duskritatma, miscreants, are unable to see him, duradarshanam. They can't see your form. But you are Advara Atmikam, worshipable by Advara means the performance of sacrifice. He says all the Vedic hymns, Chandamsi, which means the Gayatri and all the others, they are Twachi, your sense of touch in your skin. Your bodily hairs, Kusa grass. Also, if you need it for sacrifice, you sit down on it and get it around. Your eyes, Aja, ghee. Ghee is your eyes. And also, your four legs, Chaturhotram. Chaturhotram means the four priests, kinds of priests. The Hota, who does the offering, the Udgata, who chants the mantras,
The Advaryu, who is the kind of engineer who makes all the altars and is the one who can make the fire come from wood without a match, or, you know, and then a Brahmaga, overseer of the whole thing. These are the four ultras, the four priests. They're your four legs. And the shrak, Prabhupada calls it a plate. It's like a big spoon, you know, the wooden spoon that you pour ghee out of. It has this kind of spout that comes out with a curve. That's his tongue. That's why it looks like that. And the other one, the shuva, is your nostrils. Do you see that one? That's the one that has, it's split in half. And it's got this little bowl at the end and it's split into two. That's because they're his breathing holes, his nostrils. And so other things, they're all parts of the body of... anyway, they go on like this. His whole body is all various places of sacrifice personified. And sacrifice, every time there's a sacrifice, what you really do when you do a Vedic sacrifice, the soma, the big ones, the agnistoma, is really you kind of reenact the creation of the universe. All, everything is there. Brahma creates the universe. Brahma is the priest. He's the Brahma, and he creates the universe by sacrifice, using as the ingredients the body of the Lord, the bodily parts of the Lord. So this is their sage, the sages, this is their understanding. O Lord, you're the supreme personality of Godhead and are worshipable by universal prayers. Akila mantra, devata. Vedic hymns and sacrificial ingredients, we offer our obeisances unto you. You can be realized by the pure mind, freed from all visible and invisible material contamination. We offer our respectful obeisances to you as the supreme spiritual master of knowledge and devotional service. These are nice. Anyway, we should stop.
When we think of a person, at least I think that the person is some abgeschlossen.
Limited.
Not limited. It's some entity.
Yeah, right.
But we sometimes see personalities of Godhead. If we think of Krishna Balaram, mm-hmm. and they interact also.
Yeah.
So God interacts with himself.
All the time.
How to understand this? Because when we think of a person, we think it's one person and another person is another person. Mm. But we have here the personalities of
Godhead that interact with each other.
Interact with themselves. So is Balaram Krishna and Krishna Balaram, or how is it to understand?
Yeah, it's true. He does that. You can do it a little bit on the mental platform. Sometimes you talk to yourself. Sometimes, when I was a child, I had an imaginary friend. Maybe many children do this. They have imaginary friends they talk to. But who's that imaginary friend? He's another aspect of myself. So we do something like that. So... So Krishna does it, but his is on the spiritual platform. He performs these pastimes. Of course, we cannot imagine what it would be like to be Krishna. He's so far above our own platform that I don't think I have to understand it. I can just appreciate it. Because I can understand it, to say it doesn't exist is to make me the measure of all things. You know, and if you look at it, I don't understand anything. You take this desk and you know, what is sitting on the mind of this? How is it solid? Yeah, I don't understand this. So it's stupid just because I don't understand something to say it, you know, can't exist or
So we have to appreciate Krishna. Wow, look at what he does. It's so amazing. People get distressed when they find out that God is amazing, astonishing, mind-boggling, mind-blowing. But yeah, if he's not, he's not God. If you're not totally surprised and totally amazed, that, you know, who's interested in a person that's boring? So Krishna is quite astounding, and the more astounding, the more I like him.
Yeah. When we see the worship of Brahma, then we see only in India they only have one temple, and there's not so much worship. We don't know so much about the worship of Brahma. Mm-hmm. But because I'm doing the interreligious dialogue, I'm also, you know, a little bit, I don't know, because we want to think, or we want to make people think that actually the Christians, they worship Brahma, because he's creating the world in 7 days, and they say also God created the world in 7 days, but actually I don't believe it. I have a problem with this understanding that the Christians, they worship Brahma. I think they also worship God, but this very simplified the whole religious kind of thing. Of, I don't know. I just sometimes the Christians, they want to make us down by saying this is like the Srimad Bhagavatam is in the new Sanskrit and it cannot be so old. And they make all
kinds of things. Well, you should see what this. We can take the same stuff about their scriptures. You know, the scholars have gone to town. The Gospels
them,
and everything.
And we want to make them down. They say they just worship Brahma.
Well, I don't. The activities that are described in the beginning of the Old Testament, the Christians call it the Old Testament, the Torah. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and so on. That is the activities of Brahma, as described. But that doesn't mean that there, and so that's maybe how something that God does is manifest to them. But depending on their conception, really, who's doing it? I mean, Brahma is Krishna's agent. So whatever Brahma is doing, he's doing as an agent of the Supreme Lord. So, you know, he's not, you know, it may not be. They may not be worshipping Brahma. They may be worshipping Krishna. They may not exactly understand that this is done by an agent of Krishna. But if you look in their understanding of what they mean by the Lord, okay, it's all right. Even they have some idea of the absolute truth, although it's not nearly as clear and unconfused as it is in the Vedas. So a lot of times they say, yeah, they're not worshipping God, they're worshipping a demigod. And I say, it depends. It really depends upon the idea that they have. You know, the 7 days, I mean, very early on, Jewish and Christian commentators, St. Augustine even, you know, all they said these are not earth days. Yeah, I mean that's, you know, it's only lately that everybody's become stupider. But if this is before the earth is created and before the night and the day have been divided, then what kind of days are they? You know, this is understood by ancient, you know, older rabbis and Christians a long time ago. Because you can find plenty of Christian authorities. Go to St. Augustine, who understands, you know, they understand this a little better. It couldn't be earth days. How long, they don't know. We know what kalpas are and so on. There's some small fund of knowledge. So I just, you know, I mean it's true. I think Prabhupada is correct when you say that it's, you know, not the graduate scripture. There's some, but nevertheless, even if you have a primary book and your first book of arithmetic, still this is true. There's truth in it, and you can come good at it. You can go far. And with scripture, you know, you can go quite. Yeah, if a spiritual process takes place, you also get guidance by God, and you can go even, you know, to very high links. I would think that if a Christian, if he does a few things, if he understands, if he becomes not a meat eater, and follows basically the four regular principles, I become quite advanced just on the basis of that text. And that person, when they encounter Bhagavatam, will also recognize it. So anyway, I just can't anymore, you know, judge. What do you think of Christianity? I just deal with one Christian or another Christian. Some are advanced and some are not advanced. So, what about the Hare Krishna movement? It's clear that many Christians are not worshiping demigods. But others, in effect, even though they simply want fruit of results for their worship, I mean, basically their consciousness is on the level of demigod worship. That's a fact. Anything else? Yeah?
You said that, you mentioned the quote Shri Prabhupada saying that Krishna appears in all forms of life.
Mm-hmm.
In my books about Bhagavad Gita, they also mentioned that Krishna appeared as a bee on a lotus leaf. And how do we know that we worship the original Krishna? We worship Krishna as a human-like form. Maybe the bees, and the beast, I don't know how it works. Krishna appears also in their species. He appears in all kinds of forms.
How much do you know about the Hamsa avatar? I don't know anything. I know he exists. I hear about the swanning, but I don't know a thing about him. There's so many. How do we know Krishna is the supreme? I just take the Bhagavatam's word for it. Krishna is two Bhagavan Swaya.
Maybe the beast also.
Huh?
Maybe the beast also has their books.
I don't think they read. They're not the beings that I know.
Maybe have their system of knowledge.
Huh?
Animals, they sense these catastrophes much long time before we do. Maybe they have their system of.
Well, that's what. Are you an animal or a human? You better take the human form. I'm not even sure. In fact, it is not the fact that when Krishna appears, and like you see, and when he appears as Varaha, he doesn't come to save the swine. When he comes as a tortoise, he doesn't seem to come to save the aquatics or the that's an amphibious animal. I mean, the terrapins or whatever, the fish, he doesn't come to save the fish. In case he's acting for humans. Now, maybe the fish gets some benefit of association, but the fish couldn't understand him. It says, that's another one. That when they saw the moon, when the moon appeared in the milk ocean, they said, oh, look at that big fish. Anyway, they have their limited understandings, and still the general rule that you can only make spiritual advancement in the human form of life, that you have to come to the human form of life. So it's very unusual for an animal to go directly back home, back to God. It happens. It happens occasionally, but that's not the general rule. So this is what we know. I have to accept it.
For me, when I hear all this incarnation from Krishna, it's like the grace from God that he appeared in his forms is like a theater. Because sometimes he appears like a woman, walking in the world, sometimes like animals. And he appeared in this form that we become attached to him, and he made all these pastimes. He know how to do this, but he do this that we become attached to him, because we cannot see him subtly. So he take all these forms to show himself, and that we say, okay, he's a great.
That's right. That's correct. Yeah, Prabhupada said, you know, you've heard that God is great, but you don't know how great he is. Now I'll give you an idea. That's good. Okay, yeah?
When Krishna appeared, he made so much endeavor to show us that he's a transcendental personality. He appeared in the mind of Vibhaki, then he was transferred, and then he came in the vision form of the Subhavi. But when he disappeared, he left like a, so one has the impression there's a material body left.
Mm.
So then again one is in bewilderment, you know, and then it's like a trick or
The way it's usually explained is he did this just to not overwhelm the atheists. In other words, if they, people want to still not believe him, give them some reason. to do this, not you don't want to interfere with people's freedom. Remember how Vraha, how he appears, you know, he comes out of Brahma's nose. Comes up here. Yeah, his appearances are much more interesting than his disappearances. That's true. I don't know why. Sometimes we just have to say we don't know. I asked Prabhupada this question once. I said, you know, if Krishna is all powerful, why does he need so many demigods to run the universe? And Prabhupada just looked at me in this certain way and he said, you don't know how to run a universe. And I had to admit, that's true. So sometimes you just have to say, you know, it's beyond. Krishna does what he wants to do for his own reasons. Sometimes we see acharyas explain it okay, but otherwise you have to deal with it. Yeah. It's getting late. We should go, huh? Well, yeah, we should go. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.